Cheek gave a long exhale of tar and nicotine and pain and began selling. "Okay," I said. "It's about this guy. You'd recognize him. His name is Matt, and he's about 50 years old. And he's very, very famous from doing a super beloved TV show years ago. But now, when the movie starts, we meet him, and he's got a pot belly. There are piles of empty pizza boxes in his apartment, all piled up like a totem in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know, the one they made of mashed potatoes. Anyway, his life is a little bit of a mess. He's lost. Then, out of the blue, a distant relative of his dies and leaves him $2 billion, and he uses the money to become a superhero." "I love it," says Adam. Then he said, "Did you really inherit $2 billion? Adam's a funny guy. "No, no," I said, "it's just the character who inherits the money." "Does any of that spark anything with you? Because if it does, what's our next move? You're the big shoulders." "I'm not really the big shoulders," Adam said, though we both knew he is. I appreciated his modesty, but modesty won't get you even a fuck you in Hollywood. "What do you mean?" I said. "Of course you're the big shoulders. This was, after all, Adam McKay, the guy who directed Anchorman and Step Brothers and a bunch of other big stuff. At the time we were chatting, he was making Don't Look Up, the movie about a giant asteroid heading towards Earth. You know, the one that stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Timothy Chalamet, Mark Rylance, Cate Blanchett, Tyler Perry, Jonah Hill, Ariana Grande, and Meryl Streep. Amazing cast. I was in Don't Look Up at one point, too. And even though I was also heading to rehab in Switzerland, I nevertheless went to Boston to shoot my bit. While there, I pitched a line to Adam that he loved and which became the blow to the scene, which is what you're always hoping for. He ended up not using the scene. Shit happens. No bigs. The point being, Adam McKay and I got along really well. And here he was, loving my pitch. At the time, I was in pain from the scar tissue from the surgeries, so I needed pain meds. But I'd get addicted to them, of course, which only caused more damage to my insides. But feeling a bit better, I was happy recently when I got a call from Adam. We were just chatting, but in Hollywood, there's no such thing as just chatting. So I figured, what the hell? Why is he calling me? And when he never seemed to get to his point, I seized the moment and pitched him my idea. "Anyway, Mr. Big Shoulders," I said, ignoring his false modesty, "what do you think?" You know when there's a pause in a conversation that in hindsight you wish could have lasted forever so you don't have to hear the rest of it? "I don't think you're talking to the person you think you're talking to," Adam said. "What? Well, who is this?" I said. "It's Adam McLean. We met 6 years ago. I'm a computer salesman." If you've seen Don't Look Up, you'll know that at the end, well, let's just say that when I realized it was Adam McLean, not Adam McKay, a huge fucking asteroid smacked into my brain. I have a history in this kind of shit, too. Years earlier, Bruce Willis won the People's Choice Award for Best Actor for The Sixth Sense and asked me to present it to him. That night, backstage, I met Haley Joel Osment and M. Night Shyamalan and spoke to both of them for about 10 minutes. 6 months later, I was with some friends at the Sunset Marquee Hotel, and who should walk in but M. Night Shyamalan. "Hey, Matthew," he said, "long time no see. Can I sit down?" Can he sit down? He had just written and directed The Sixth Sense. He was the next Steven Spielberg. Of course he can sit down. I was a few drinks in and having a good time. This is when alcohol alone still worked for me. Eventually, my friends filtered out, and it was just M. Night and me sitting there, kicking it. I remember making a mental note that we were not talking about show business at all, just talking about love and loss and girls and L.A. and all the other stuff people chat about at bars. He seemed like he was having a really good time, too, laughing at all my dumb jokes, and I began to think, hey, this guy likes me. He must be just a huge Friends fan or something, because he really seems super focused on everything I'm saying. I usually never do this. I've been burned by this line of thinking way too many times. But I began to have wild fantasies about what this could do for my career. He told me that there was another bar that had just opened across town and asked me if I wanted to go with him. Did I want to go with him? He was M. Night fucking Shyamalan. Of course I wanted to go with him. We went to the valet, picked up our cars, and I followed him across town to this new place, all the while certain that I was going to be the star of his next huge movie. Yeah, there was going to be a new, awesome, twisty movie, and the trick ending was going to be me. My head was doing cartwheels. I can't explain why. He just seemed like he loved me and my work. And I was just drunk enough to think that this was going to be a life-changing night. As we took our seats at the new place, I felt comfortable, read drunk, enough to say that we should work together sometime. All at once, a strange look came across his face, and I remember immediately regretting having said it. He excused himself to go to the bathroom, and while he was gone, someone I knew a bit came up to me and asked me how my night was going. I said, "Well, I've been hanging out with M. Night Shyamalan all night. I'm telling you, the guy loves me." My buddy was impressed. That is, until M. Night returned from the bathroom. "Maddie," my pal said, looking closely at M. Night, "could I have a word in private?" This was weird as fuck, but drink will make almost anything plausible, so I stepped away from my magical evening with M. Night for a moment. "Maddie, my friend, that is not M. Night Shyamalan." This revelation caused me to attempt to fully focus my vodka-softened eyes for a moment, and through the gloom of the dark bar, I squinted hard at N. Night Shyamalan. Not even close. Turns out M. Night was actually just an Indian gentleman who looked the tiniest bit like M. Night Shyamalan. Maybe it was N. Night Shyamalan. And who was, in reality, the maitre d' at Mr. Chow's Beverly Hills, a hip restaurant in L.A. that I frequented, and that I no longer frequent because I told its maitre d' that we should work together sometime. What kind of a night did he think he was having? I thought. Chapter 3. Baggage. I lived in a perpetual state of Groundhog Day. It's my favorite movie for a reason. Every evening I would head to the Formosa Cafe on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood with my friends. There were two signs over the bar. The one under all the headshots read, "Where the Stars Dine." The other read, "Wine by the Glass." But we didn't drink by the glass. We drank by the pint, and the quart, and the gallon. And vodka, not wine. "We" was Hank Azaria, David Pressman, Craig Bierko, and me. We had formed our very own mini Rat Pack. I'd met Hank first when I was 16. We were at the CBS lot auditioning for a pilot starring Ellen Green of Little Shop of Horrors. We both got cast, and he played my uncle in the pilot. We got along so well that when I left the nest to move out on my own, I moved into a studio apartment in his building. He was already a seriously funny guy, and by the time I'd met him, he was doing a ton of voiceover work. That gig would eventually lead him to becoming an incredibly wealthy guy. But back at the start of it, all we wanted was fame. Fame, fame, fame. That's all we wanted. Girls and fame. It was all we cared about, because at least for me, I figured being famous would fill that great hole that was endlessly growing inside of me. But being pre-famous, it was a hole I filled with alcohol. I was drinking all the time. I spent my college years drinking at the Formosa. In fact, in drinking, I got a 4.0 GPA and was alcool beta kappa. Love of alcohol had indeed become the helmsman of my life. But I don't think I realized just how much it controlled me until one night when I was out with my girlfriend at the time, Gabby. Gabby would go on to write for Veep and a bunch of other stuff and be a friend for life. But that night, she and I and a group of friends went to a magic show in Universal City. I remember ordering some specialty drink simmering with alcohol to sip while the guy produced rabbits out of his hats or whatever, but eventually the endless lines of silk scarves out of sleeves grew wearisome, and we all headed back to Gabby's apartment to hang out. Gabby didn't have any alcohol at home, which, of course, was totally fine. But for me, at the age of 21, all of a sudden this creeping feeling came over me for the first time. I felt my blood on fire for more to drink. I really wanted another drink, and I could think of nothing else. It was right then when I first felt the obsession for alcohol. I noticed that no one else seemed the slightest bit fazed by the lack of drink at Gabby's. But I had that overpowering pull like a great magnet, and I was just little shards of iron. I was freaked out by this, especially as it was me and only me who seemed to be struggling. So I decided not to go find more drink that night, but it left me unable to sleep, uncomfortable, tossing and turning, lost to it, restless, irritable, and discontented until the sun finally rose. What's happening to me? What's wrong with me? Why was I the only person who had been dying for another drink? I couldn't tell anyone this was happening because even I didn't understand it. I think for many years my drinking was a secret to people. Well, at least the extent of it. Certainly back then I was just a college-age kid wasting the equivalent of his college years on booze and women and making my guy friends and women laugh. What was there to admit? But what no one knew was I was drinking alone. That remained a secret. How much I drank when I was drinking alone depended entirely on the year. Eventually, I'd work my way up to the party bottle with the handle, killed that in 2 days, by myself. But that night of the magic show, even then I was freaking out. What's going on? I've never experienced this feeling before in my life. Why can't I think of a single fucking solitary thing except for a drink? If you're at a bar, you just ordered another drink. But when it's the middle of the night, you don't tend to lie awake wishing you had one in your hand. That was new. That was different. That was terrifying. And that was a secret. 10 years later, I read the following words in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Drinkers think they are trying to escape, but really they are trying to overcome a mental disorder they didn't know they had. Eureka! Someone understands me. But reading that was both wonderful and horrible. It meant I wasn't alone. There were others who thought like me. But it also meant I was an alcoholic and would have to quit drinking one day at a time for the rest of my life. How was I ever going to have fun again? I can't decide if I actually like people or not. People have needs. They lie, cheat, steal, or worse, they want to talk about themselves. Alcohol was my best friend because it never wanted to talk about itself. It was just always there, the mute dog at my heel, gazing up at me, always ready to go on a walk. It took away so much of the pain, including the fact that when I was alone, I was lonely. And then when I was with people, I was lonely too. It made movies better, songs better, it made me better. It made me comfortable with where I was instead of wishing I was somewhere, anywhere else. It made me content to hang out with the woman in front of me, rather than continually wondering if life would be better if I were dating someone else. It took away being an outsider in my own family. It removed the walls around me, except one, even if for a little while. It allowed me to control my feelings and, in doing so, control my world. Like a friend, it was there for me, and I was fairly certain I would go crazy without it. And I'm right about that, by the way. I would have gone crazy without it. It made me want to be a completely different person. To give it up seemed impossible. Learning to move forward in life without it was tantamount to asking someone to go about his day without breathing. For that, I will always be grateful to alcohol. It finally beat me into a state of reasonableness. According to Malcolm Gladwell, if you did anything for 10,000 hours, you could be an expert. This made me an expert in two areas, 1980s tennis and drinking. Only one of those subjects is important enough to save a life. I'll let you guess which one. But when I wanted to feel less alone among people, it was Hank Azaria, David Pressman, and eventually Craig Bierko I chose. Weirdly, I'd played a character with the surname Azarian on Beverly Hills 90210, getting a guest spot on episode 19 of the 22-episode first season was a big deal. Beverly Hills 90210 hadn't yet reached a cultural phenomenon status. By the time I played Roger Azarian, Beverly Hills High tennis star and the son of a hard-charging, distant businessman father. But the themes in that episode, teen depression, suicide, and learning disabilities, marked it out as a show that wouldn't shy away from real shit, however privileged its milieu. The episode, which borrowed its title from T.S. Eliot, of all people, April is the Cruelest Month, opens with me hitting the crap out of tennis balls, showing off my Canadian ranked form, my big whipped forehand and aggressive backhand winners showcasing the fact that I could really play. I was even using a throwback Bjorn Borg-style wooden Donne racket with a tiny head, which I managed to break in the scene by hitting too hard. Jason Priestley, in the role of Brandon Walsh, noting my thinly veiled rage, proceeds to ask me how many rackets I go through in a week, and in an art-imitating life moment, I say, depends on whose face I see on the ball. I couldn't escape stairwells, even when I was playing a fictional character on TV. By the end of the episode, I've shared a screenplay with Brandon, gotten drunk, held a gun to my own face, and ended up in a locked psychiatric ward. Only the gun bit was play-acting. The rest was method. I wasn't yet 22. For a few years, I'd been a guest actor, doing a series here, a series there, guest starring roles. The point was, I was working. My first biggish break had come when I was cast in Second Chance, though my casting was overshadowed by who wasn't cast. I still think Second Chance had a great premise. A 40-year-old guy called Charles Russell dies in a hovercraft accident, because that happens all the time, and goes to see St. Peter in his office. If the light shines gold on Charles as he stands in judgment, he goes to heaven. If it shines red, he goes to hell. But if it shines blue, as it does in Mr. Russell's case, he was called a blue lighter, meaning they didn't know what to do with him. So St. Peter decides to send him back to Earth to meet his 15-year-old self and guide him through a life of better decision-making. That way, by the time he once again boards a hovercraft at 40, when he dies the second time, because he's a better person, the light will change from we don't know what to do with them blue to we're sold, welcome to eternity gold. Can you think of a more perfect premise for a father-son acting team? And my father and I duly auditioned. Then, disaster. I got a green light to be the son of a blue lighter, and Dad got no light at all. They want you. They don't want me, Dad said when he heard the news. I guess I threw him a hard-to-read look. After all, I'd gotten a huge part, even if he hadn't. So I imagine my face was combined sorrow for him and glee for me. So much that he said, do I have to repeat it? They want you. They don't want me. My father's hurt feelings aside, I had just booked my first TV show. I was making $5,000 a week. I was 17 years old. My ego was off the charts. I thought I was the shit, like everyone else thought Second Chance was. It came in as number 93 out of 93 ranked shows that season. For the final 9 episodes after the initial 13, the whole St. Peter blue lighter stuff had been forgotten, and the show just followed me and my pals in our various adventures. So it didn't matter that the show remained 93rd in the list of 93. Someone important had liked me enough to build a show around me. which only increased my ego to epic proportions, and might well have set me up for success later. My father dealt with the news by not attending a single taping except the very last one. He had his reasons, I suppose. Accordingly, I was able to score various guest roles after that, and 2 years later I got another series, this time in a show starring